I'm Jason Pack.
And I'm Alex Hall-Hall, and this is Disorder,
a podcast where we try to find novel ways, including ways to leverage smallness, to order the disorder of our mad, 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 mad world.
This is also the podcast described by my husband in a very backhanded compliment as, quote, surprisingly good. In today's episode, we're going to hear part two of our discussion with Dr. Armen Sarkissian, Armenia's former president from 2018 to 2022, and also its former prime minister. If you haven't yet heard part one, please do go back and listen to it. It's in our last week's episode, where Jason and Dr. Sarkissian talk about the legacy of the Armenian genocide, the ethnic cleansing in Nagorno-Karabakh, what it was like growing up in the Soviet Union, and how the Soviets actually had a form of capitalism within their education sector. It's a great episode.
And in today's episode, we're going to hear more of Dr. Sarkissian's ideas, particularly his pretty revolutionary idea that the small states of the world could actually band together to form a club. And then, after hearing from Armen, Alex and I are going to try to use this idea to order our very disorderly world. So small states are pretty important. Taiwan produces the best semiconductors. Qatar exports a huge amount of natural gas, which we need to make the world tick. Places like Armenia and Israel invent a lot of technology and they export a lot of human capital. Botswana exports a huge amount of the world's diamonds. So small states are not of small importance. And there is a unique role that small states can have in our current order. Let's hear from Dr. Sarkissian about his unique ideas about the role small states can play in the world.
If before and during the Cold War and the world was one polar, or I would say one dimensional, now probably the world is three dimensional minimum. One is the military power. United States is still one simple strongest power. Others will try to catch up, including China and others. The second dimension is probably the economic one. And the third one is the dimension of the future, basically how modern you are. And this is where the world is already multi-dimensional, because when you look at a lot of states, especially the small, smart states, they are much more successful than even the big empires and so on and so forth. So this is on the third dimension, which is becoming more and more important because it includes new technology, artificial intelligence, new ways of managing. And basically you ask a simple question to people. Which country is the richest on the planet? You'll get many.
Qatar.
No, Norway.
Depends on if you use purchasing power parity or.
No. I think I like Qatar very much, but I like the example of Norway because per capita it's the highest. I like it because it's not the whole economy of and behavior of Norway is not based on oil and gas.
Correct.
They do have, but Norway is a country that 95% of their electricity needs are produced by hydropower.
Yes.
And much more than their needs, they produce together with hydro, with wind, and basically whatever they have in oil and gas, they sell. They have the one of the biggest, or maybe the biggest state fund, which is $1.6 trillion
Correct.
And so on. So Norway is an example. Qatar is an example. United
yes.
Arab Emirates. Ireland is an example. So there are rising small states and they are becoming more and more powerful because the third dimension becomes important and it's basically has huge influence on dimension two on economy and dimension one on military. Future military is artificial intelligence technology.
So if I could step back, I really agree with this contention, which is that because the world is changing so rapidly and technology is changing so rapidly, thinking about the future and reshaping how you run your society, both from an economic and a values perspective, is so critical. And small states are maybe more nimble. When it came time for Norway to set up its sovereign wealth fund, which was a novel concept, or to pivot into green energy, it could do it so much easier than the United States because it was a small and nimble state with a flexible culture. And this really gets at the heart of your fascinating and readable book, The Small States Club, how small, smart powers can save the world. Obviously, you've had a lot of experience as a head of state of a small state, but what initially led you to this idea?
The world that we described together was the macro world, the classical world. But there is a second world which is happening now and is the micro, on the micro level. And that's why I call the world the quantum world. And that quantum world, new world, the changes that are happening fundamentally in our, on our planet, in human societies, are connected with revolutionary achievements of science and specifically quantum physics. You will go back 100 years ago, the world of physics was in disorder, using your term. Why it was in disorder? Because there were classical physics created by giants like Isaac Newton and others that was not working. And the logic was not working. Not only the physics was not working, logic was not working when they were examining small objects like atoms or elementary particles. But what happened? Human genius, people like Albert Einstein, Heisenberg, and many others, basically understood in order to understand the quantum world, the small world, first of all, you have to change your logic, the way you approach it. Because that is a world where there is no very determined behavior of particles like in classical mechanics. There is always probability, and the way the elementary particle behaves, you cannot describe that in a normal ways of classical mechanics. So you change your logic, the way you basically approach it. That's a historic thing. But discoveries of quantum mechanics were the basis of what we have today. This recording studio, your mobile phones, sending satellites to the space, speaking to our friends in Australia live. Okay, all of that is quantum mechanics. So technology has been changing the world technologically, but was changing human society as well. The way we run our life, the way we live, we were not noticing that.
I think one of the things you bring out that small states have been able to do is to leverage human and diasporic capital differently than large states. So if we think of Ireland, Armenia, Israel, Estonia, Singapore, and you devote a chapter to each of these in your book, you can see that each of those five countries is an intellectual powerhouse, a small country, an intellectual powerhouse. And the first three, Ireland, Armenia, and Israel, they leverage their global diasporas. So in a world where intellectual capital is everything, how can small states uniquely leverage their position to promote human capital?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. But yeah, I think we have to try to take it a bit higher and examine every and each case of success. I'm examining not every and each small state, the ones that are smart. This is a state and with a leadership that understood the realities. It's the state that is very, very pragmatic, had a clear understanding of its place, its values, strengths and weaknesses, had a vision, and the vision that is sold to the general public, to the nation, had a clear-cut national identity. National identity with the vision creates a mission for the state, and that mission drives you. You can start with a lot of oil, or your strength is your country, like in the case of Norway, but they have managed whatever they have exactly with the top optimization and good quality. And there are nations like, as you said, Ireland and Israel and Armenia that can use their diaspora, their manpower. Armenia has one asset, it's the human asset. There are four or five times more Armenians living abroad than in Armenia. There are many countries when the leading politicians are Armenian, scientists, businessmen. So that's your power. So I always had the dream that Armenia should become a country, a small state, but a global nation. That's the model. A small state, but a global nation.
Like Ireland.
Like Ireland. I mean, look at Ireland, I mean. Look at the achievements they have. I think around half of the American presidents are of Irish origin. And all of them are visiting Ireland. And Ireland, this or that, what gets the support of the American and the Western businesses. They have the right policies and so on. There are other countries like Estonia. They are very smart and becoming one of the leading countries on electronic government and optimized the best governing countries in the world. So in this new world that I call it quantum world, the things are changing. Those who are smart and the small ones that are smart can change things much more. That small states today can be independent, powerful, needed. The issue with Gaza, which country is helping to negotiate? A small, tiny country like Qatar.
Correct.
It's not Switzerland like it was classically before. It's Qatar today. The first university on artificial intelligence, where is it? In Abu Dhabi, in Masdar City. Not in California.
Yes.
Not in Washington State. No, not in Paris or in London. It was in Abu Dhabi.
And if we look at, you mentioned the Emirates and Qatar, the Qataris have cultivated mediation relationships with the Taliban, with Russia and Ukraine, with Iran, with Hamas, that larger powers never could do. So smallness can be an advantage because some of the challenges in this world are crawling underneath the table. And when you need to crawl underneath the table, being big is a disadvantage.
Now we are coming to the subtitle of the book, which is how the small states can save the world. First of all, everybody, including big empires, have to restart valuing and reorganizing institutions. Classically, how do we vote politically? Every 4 or 5 years, you go to the ballot, put the paper. MP is elected. You're lucky. The MP comes twice or three times a year to visit constituency. Yeah, fine. How do people vote today? 5 to 10 times on Facebook. So there is no way that the classical way of democracy continuing the way it is and that a new way, quantum way of voting can live together in this environment. We have to redesign it, bring the new era, the new thinking of this quantum era into reality. Here in UK, there were several changes of prime ministers. Through ballot? No. Through the public opinion that has pushed the prime ministers out. Was it right or wrong? I leave aside. I'm just saying the facts. So in this new world, when military power will be connected with high-tech, when economic achievements will be connected with new technology, best management, small states can be very, very powerful.
And they can come up with more novel ways of doing the quantum democracy. Like you mentioned Estonia, which has made advances in digital voting that really makes it as the world leader. And clearly the way things are going, digital voting and the relationship between political leadership and individuals through technology is going to be something that the U.S. is going to need to save its democracy. And we can learn from the Estonians.
Exactly. And here it comes to, you just take simple statistics from Bloomberg, European Union, anywhere. Which are the top 10 countries that are the best in innovation? Excluding UK and US, all the others are small states.
Could this be because of a division of labor whereby it's impossible for, let's say, a medium power like France to focus exclusively on semiconductor manufacturing, but it is possible for a Singapore or Taiwan to focus really laser focused on one thing? Do you think that that's going on?
You gave the example of Taiwan. In the years 2000s, 2010, when I was in business, I also had a center at Cambridge University called Eurasia Center for 12 years. And the focus was on Eurasia. Why? Because that was the most booming place on the planet. And we were having academic conferences and visits and so on. And I visited China several times. It's a completely different model when you have strategic thinking, which has come from the top, they took me to a semiconductor factory, a new one. There was a huge, like, double of Wembley. But the whole production was 10% of that. So this is, why you build all of this when your production said? So we have a plan to have 60, 70% of the world semiconductor production of that specific type in China. So we are building a building that will be a home of that. So that's a completely different way of doing. France cannot afford itself because of many factors, because China is still run with ideological pragmatism.
Yes.
Well, ideological, but pragmatism.
Yes, yes, yes.
While the West had to be run by complete sort of business common sense and pragmatic approach. I'm not saying what is right, what is wrong, but one thing is clear, that small states are becoming more and powerful. If even 50 years ago you had to be under an umbrella as a small state of a big power, now the big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
Oh, that's very interesting. Tell us more.
Who represents and where the small states are represented? Yes, of course they are represented at the United Nations. Yes, of course Estonia is and Ireland are members of European Union. Fine. But there is G20. There is G7. There was G8. Where the small states were not there at all. Okay? Their power is growing. And a club, not an organization. This is not like ASEAN. This is not like any other. This is not regional. It's a club where they come together and basically share with each other the source of their success, build up relations, and basically talk about the power. Because all of the small states, at the end of the day, need stability more than the big ones. Most of the small states, they don't have, they don't have ideas of expansion and all of that. They value stability. Singapore values stability. Qatar needs a stability. Emirates need a stability. Ireland needs a stability for their success. Because their success is based on the effectiveness of what's happening.
And when you're using the word stability, I would even say order. That the very Definitely. Nature of the volatility around a small state can harm it. And this is maybe a good place for us to pivot to some things about Armenia, because in your book, you take a very realistic approach to your own nation, which is that it has not succeeded the way that other small states have, either economically, either militarily, or geostrategically. And I would argue that this is because its neighborhood is even more challenging and it hasn't been able to benefit from order. Whereas, if you look at UAE, Qatar, Israel, they have a superpower patron who defends them and provides order. And since fall of Soviet Union, Armenia has been connected to Russia, but increasingly since events that you were a part of, the revolution in 2018 and the rise of Pashinyan, Armenia is drifting towards the West and is between Russia and the West, and no one is willing to defend it the way that, say, the UAE is defended by America. This is a small state that has not benefited from order.
What you are describing could be described as one of the reasons. There are many other reasons, external and internal. If you speak about European small states or even in the Gulf, it's absolutely clear their relations with superpowers, who the superpowers are. But Armenia historically was always in between two empires. One, the Ottoman Empire, that disappeared and has reappeared again with the strength of Turkey, military strength of Turkey. And the other one is the Russian Empire. I think the whole idea is how do you survive in that sort of an environment? That's one issue. Can you do that or not? And I say that if you are a small but smart state and you make your decisions right, then you will succeed. In my book, I'm telling a story of an Armenian kingdom state of Cilicia, which basically existed after the fall of the Armenian capital of Ani. We are speaking about after 10th or 11th century. For more than 300 years on Mediterranean, always surrounded by enemies or competitors. During the 300 years, there were more than 20 states that came and disappeared. They managed to create alliances with Damascus, with Mongols against Byzantine Empire, created relations with Venice against something. There was internal stability run by one family, the royal family, Lusignans. And for 300 years, that small Armenian population was around 2 million only. They survived 300 years because they got a lot of things right and valuations were absolutely based on national interest, national identity and your culture, and they were very, very pragmatic. So if 700 years ago, the same Armenians could survive, create a small state, how on earth we're not doing that? We're not being pragmatic. We're not making the right choices today. Internally, we have a problem. Now, I would say that, see, our discussions, we're speaking about comparing Armenia, Israel, and Ireland diaspora. Okay, the Armenian constitution says, initial one, now it's a bit better, that the Armenian president should be living the last 10 years in Armenia and have only Armenian passport for the last 10 years.
That's crazy.
Now it's 6 years, but, and that Armenian MP has to be, and minister, basically, MP has to be living the last 4 years only in Armenia and have only Armenian passport. This is a world that is interconnected. Your main power are the Armenians living abroad. If you are 3 million Armenians, a bit more, 3 million, you have 4 or 5 times more Armenians living abroad.
The wealth of the Armenian diaspora is 5, 10, 20 times the wealth of Armenia, the country.
Even more. And basically, the wealth is not only the money. The wealth is
human capital.
Human capital is phenomenal, the experience of people. I mean, you take this country. In Britain, one of the most famous doctors is Lord Darcy, the guy that was very much involved in creating the health politics, and so not only here, but in America, in Japan, in the same Qatar. Lord Darcy can be Minister of Health in UK. He cannot be Minister of Health in Armenia. The guy who created Moderna, his name is Nubar Afeyan from MIT, professor. Nubar Afeyan has also Armenian passport, and I gave it to him. But he cannot be Minister of Science in Armenia. So you have all of that. I'm not speaking about...
And it's exactly the opposite, essentially, of how the Israelis handle the situation, right?
Exactly.
It's 100% the opposite.
Well, basically, I do remember years ago when the first deputy of general director or IMF, Mr. Fisher, got Israeli citizenship today and became head of Bank of Israel tomorrow.
I love this idea of small state and global nation because everyone has to leverage his own unique strength. And if you're Armenia, you need to leverage the strengths that you have. And those strengths are going to be different than if you're Botswana.
Yeah, exactly.
And both states can succeed, but they need to, as you say, think pragmatically, what do I have to offer? And if Armenia cuts itself off from its diaspora, it's losing so much. So why don't we use this as a moment to pivot? If you could bring into being one new institution at a global level for coordination, what would it be?
Well, I don't think that we are in a position now to create one organization that will create, because the new order, so-called, after this disorder, and that new order is going to be absolutely quantum, because we have to redefine many things, starting how we basically run democracy, how we live in a world where there were several superpowers economically, how we run international trade.
So what institution would you like to see created?
I will not think about creating an institution that will resolve all of that, but I will think about importance and absolute necessity of an organization that can contribute
Okay.
And that organization is the S20.
S20.
The S20 should represent all of the small states, bringing together 20, the most powerful, the most successful, the most smart nations. In fact, membership of S20 could be a sort of a not fixed. If you fail as a smart state, you can be replaced by others and be a dialogue partner with the big states, with G7, G20. It should represent small states at the G20, G7, for example, and at the United Nations, not as a lion military economic, no, as a club of these states that come together, because the impact of smaller states will grow every day tomorrow. Countries that are small will become more and more powerful. And in order to have a global balance, in order to come to a new pragmatism, which has also the values of liberal democracy, the new quantum liberal democracy that take cares of the changed world, but also it has the very important ingredients of value and culture and morality. Okay, you have to hear the voices of the small, and the smalls, instead of becoming entourage for big ones, they will become the new battlefield where the big ones have to fight, not militarily,
hopefully, but not
diplomatically, to fight to get their attention, their friendship.
Yes.
So small states worldwide can become that platform that will bring down the international tensions. Because the terrorist now is that in the future wars, small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones. Because of information, because the tools of the war will be not only the bombs, the number of tanks, it will be drones, it will be artificial intelligence, it will be hacking. And who is saying that basically all of these geniuses like Steve Jobs and others are only born in California? They can be born in California, they can be born in Russia, in China, in Singapore, in United Arab Emirates. They are spending so much money on educating in Qatar, in Ireland, or elsewhere. In Israel, Israel is already doing that. Look at the size of the army and technology that the small country has developed, okay? The small states will be the whole environment of bringing the tension between the several, not one, but several leading states, power blocks, in order to compete with each other to get the favors from the small states.
After the break, how could small states help us order the disorder? So, Jason, thanks for doing that interview. I think some really interesting points emerged from that, including the fact that in today's world, power and influence isn't just about size and strength, the size of your military and the number of troops at your command. There are intelligent weapons, your mastery of technology, artificial intelligence. These are all going to play a role. And also, as you alluded in the interview and just before it began, about the fact that small states can develop niche specializations like production of chips or expertise in a certain technology that gives them an advantage and makes them valuable. So I definitely think small states can have more influence in today's technological world than they used to, where it really was about brute strength. I also think that small states, in a world dominated by big beasts, there is strength in small states clubbing together and trying to avoid being sucked into blocks and refusing to play the game of the big powers, that they are aligned, that they are in the pocket of one side or the other. And unfortunately, what we're seeing in today's world, it's not exactly the Cold War, but there is a certain form of new great power politics developing, and there's a sort of fault line between authoritarian regimes and democracies. And small states, they risk being eaten alive or being torn apart in that conflict. So clubbing together and saying, we're not going to play your game and you actually are going to have to respond to us, I think there's a certain intelligence in that, and they can provide a kind of balancing role.
That's exactly right, Alex. The idea of the S20, which, you know, I never would have thought of this idea, is genius, because if the small states negotiated en masse for free trade agreements, if they worked together to get investment from larger states or worked together to even get defense guarantees, they could be like a serious player in global affairs. I mean, if you're just Kuwait, you can't make a big difference in global affairs. But if you're the entirety of the GCC nations, wow. You know, now we're talking trillions of dollars and the ability to move prices on oil and gas markets, as well as to set the terms of trade. And the small states thing is even maybe more genius than just a club of oil exporters or just a club of wealthy small countries, because the small states could be bringing together lots of different expertise, from things like intellectual property to diamonds to semiconductors. And Armin made a point, which I don't know if it's true, but I'd like to believe that it's true, which is that small states want stability because that they don't want to be gobbled up by potential competitors, so that, you know, some big states, they like a dog-eat-dog world because they think that they're the big dog. So they don't want to do the whole rule of law, you know, morality thing, because it's like, I'm a big dog. I want to be able to bark and bite. Maybe he's onto something, which is that the small states, you know, they just want to get on with, like, inventing computer programs and exporting minerals, and they want an ordered environment. So they may be uniquely positioned to be orderers.
But you still can't escape geography. This is sort of the argument against it. I mean, what I found interesting is that we have seen mini groupings play an influence, like OPEC. I mean, the OPEC countries have been able to hold other parts of the world hostage by artificially changing the amount of oil they produce or the price of that. So they have had an influence. Then you have, at the United Nations, you have different clusters or regional groupings. So the Security Council is very much sort of dominated by this sort of big power and the veto power of the five permanent members. But the idea of the UN General Assembly is that they can still be outvoted by lots and lots of small states. For example, expressing their disapproval with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So Russia can veto action in the Security Council, but it hasn't evaded the moral censure of the majority of countries on the planet. So there's that. But you then said that what small states want is a kind of security in order to survive and prosper themselves. And for security in a violent world, in the jungle, you need protectors. And that's where you can't escape your geography. If you are on the periphery of an aggressive Russia, you are going to look for protection with the US. And in order to secure protection from the US, you are effectively going to have to sort of form an alliance and cooperate with the US. Or look at small countries in the South China Seas feeling threatened by China's actions. Just in the last week or so, we have seen the Philippines take part in a summit with the US and Japanese leaders because they feel threatened by China. So they can't escape their geography, and they do need bigger protectors. So you end up then back in that logic of sort of forming alliances with bigger states and having a client relationship. And so how do you escape that physical geopolitical reality, Jason?
Stalin put this very well when he said, how many divisions does the Pope have? In other words, no matter how much moral power and, in the case of the Pope, spiritual authority, if he didn't have 20 divisions, the Nazis or the Soviets could gobble him up. And you're right, the S20 club would only work either if the world was ordered enough that no superpower threatened to gobble it up, or if the S20s were in alignment with one of the superpowers, who then would be willing to provide their security. But to think about Armin's idea, he was sketching the idea that rather than the small states being a battleground, that China and America or Russia and America would be fighting over them, but rather that they can offer unique and different things to different patrons, because smallness might be an advantage. And I want to toss this out that, you know, if you need to reach something from a high tree and pull an apple down, being tall is an advantage. But if you need to crawl underneath a car and fix an engine, being small is an advantage. And it might be that when it comes to redoing legacy infrastructure like trains or doing digital voting, Estonia is in a great position. Estonia is small enough to innovate, and it doesn't have the legacy infrastructure of the US or the UK. That nimbleness is something that I think that we can learn from the small states. So what I wanted to ask you, Alex, with your greater diplomatic experience, is when Britain or America is negotiating with South Korea or Taiwan about something, does Taiwan or South Korea always have to be in a position of deference or weakness, or no? You can be small but strong and on certain issues, be able to meet eye to eye and debate on an even playing field with stronger countries.
So I think you touched on it quite well in your interview with Dr. Sarkissian, which is, yes, smaller states have an advantage in that they can be more nimble. If their administrative structures are well set up, you can be very efficient, whereas a big state is like a tanker. It's much harder to turn a tanker around, and you've got more constituencies and more considerations to care about. The other advantage a small state has is generally they're really going to focus on their survival and the top two things their country needs. So they're really going to zero in and fight very, very hard for the absolutely essential thing that is critical to them. If you're a bigger country, you are grappling with many, many different, I mean, you have global aspirations, you have global partnerships. There are so many more considerations at play. So I remember when the UK was leaving the EU and I was in the embassy in Washington, and we were wondering about how were we going to approach the negotiation of new free trade deals. And countries around the world saw that we actually needed those deals more than they needed us. And the Canadians actually said, nope, we're not going to just roll over the deal that you used to have when you were part of the EU. We're going to try and get a little bit more out of you now. And it has proved very hard to negotiate a new deal with Canada. And the Australians and the New Zealand, as we know, they negotiated a very advantageous deal against the UK. We were desperate to get new deals with everybody. They were just picking us off one by one. There's another lesson that I picked up while we were thinking about trade. We talked to the Canadians a lot about how do they successfully renegotiate NAFTA with the Trump administration. And what the Canadians told us is that the government of Canada decided that renegotiating the NAFTA trade deal with Trump, which Trump had ripped up and said, we don't like these terms, I want to get a new deal with Canada and Mexico. NAFTA is the North American Free Trade deal between Canada, Mexico, and the US. And the Canadians said this was so critical to our economy every single aspect of our diplomacy for about 18 months was focused on this one priority. And every single cabinet minister was tasked to focus on this almost to the exclusion of everything else. And Canadian diplomats absolutely swarmed the US at the federal level, at the government level, at the local level. So a small state can do that. They can decide they have one priority and put every single effort into that. A country like the UK or the US with global responsibilities can't do that.
Yep. Funny to hear you referring to Canada as a small state. I think it might be the second largest state in geographical area and is larger than the entire European continent. But, you know.
You understand my point, though. It's about you decide on one priority.
Of course. And Canada is more nimble than the US or the UK. It has less legacy institutions, and it's able to play its global role in a more flexible manner. I think there are other things that we can learn from the small states, which is specialization. Not just
yes.
nimbleness, but we're living in a tech world right now. I cannot understand artificial intelligence and the meteorology behind climate change and play backgammon and poker and have a podcast and write a book. But if I just play backgammon, maybe I can also write a book. So if you were a small state, let's say Israel, or let's say Singapore, and you said, you know, we're pretty good at a few things. We got some good universities here. Maybe you wouldn't try to do biotech and semiconductor and trains and fiber optic cables. You'd become excellent at one thing and you'd really, really go for it. And this is something that we totally can learn from the Singaporeans, Taiwanese, and Israelis. They try to be world leading at specific, specific things. And then they import people from the diaspora and they get financing from Silicon Valley and they just really, really focus at the thing and they get so good at it. And I think that this cluster approach is something that we're beginning to get in the US. You know, like in certain areas in Texas, they're focusing on a given technical thing. And Boston is like the biotech place. And I heard Armin and I'm like, yeah, you got it exactly right. We can learn from these small states in terms of how they focus on pooling together resources and expertise and creating a culture of excellence. It can't be just random that 3 out of the last 10 chess world champions are Armenian. That's not random. But then, of course, Armenia is in a uniquely disadvantageous geostrategic position. You could say, relative to all the small states that Armin talks about in his book, his own country is in the worst position. It's not only surrounded by enemies, but it doesn't have the firm support of either superpower bloc. You could say, sure, Israel, the UAE, they might be surrounded by enemies, but they have the American superpower support. Armenia is surrounded by a million enemies from Turkey to Azerbaijan to potentially Russia. And it's not firmly in the Western camp. So what I want to ask you is, when you were ambassador to a country in the Caucasus, and this is obviously such a complicated and, you know, multivalent region, how were you able to understand what a country like Armenia or Georgia can do to prosper and to, if they want to, try to pivot away from their dependence on Russia?
So yes, that takes us back to the dilemma for small states. At the end of the day, they can't escape geopolitics and they can't escape their geography. And why are countries like Armenia and Georgia not trending out towards the Singapore or the Estonia or the Costa Rica or the more successful small states? And it is because they are prisoners of their geography and geopolitics. When I was ambassador, I once tried to describe Georgia's situation as being like, in the famous Bertolt Brecht play, the Caucasian Chalk Circle, which, for those people who haven't read it, talks about a child who is caught up in conflict, and the nanny rescues the child, and the parents abandon their daughter and flee to safety, and the nanny looks after the girl and brings her up. And after the conflict, the original parents come back and say, "We want our daughter back. She's our daughter." And the nanny says, "But I'm the one who effectively parented her and looked after her." And a judge, who as it happens to be an Azeri, says, "I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to draw a circle on the ground, and we're going to put the girl in the circle, and the birth mother and the nanny, you are each to take an arm and pull. And whoever loves the child more, their strength will pull the child and prove that they have the stronger claim to the child." And of course, what happens is each time at the last minute, the nanny lets go of the hand because she says, "That just leads to us ripping this child apart." And the judge says, "It is obvious that you actually love this child more than the birth mother, so the child is staying with you." And I feel like Georgia and Armenia are trapped in a Caucasian chalk circle. They want to draw closer to the EU and NATO, Armenia ever since its democratic revolution, but Russia is holding them by the privates, by the leverage that the unresolved conflicts give to them. And Russia is threatening them, "If you move further towards the EU and NATO, we are going to grab Abkhazia and South Ossetia forever," in Georgia's case. "And any hope you might have, Armenia, of protection against Azerbaijan, that is not going to be there either." And so the countries risk being literally torn apart as part of this wider geopolitical conflict. And it begs the question, is the kinder thing of the EU and NATO, if we're not 100% willing to let Georgia or Ukraine or Armenia into the EU and NATO, is the kinder thing not to offer it at all? Because this is a psychological nightmare for the countries in that region. They want to join. They're not sure if it's going to happen because the EU and NATO are hesitant. They're trying to implement these very difficult reforms to get there, but they're not actually sure they're going to make it. And all the while, Russia is bombarding them with psychological warfare, saying, "Don't trust those fickle friends. It's never really going to happen. And you are better sticking with us." It is a very difficult situation for them.
Russia is very good at gaslighting. And this chalk circle thing, doesn't this come from the Talmud? I mean, was it King Solomon or King David? They bring the baby to him and there's the mother and the stepmother. And he's like, "Well, the solution is each one grabs a leg and pulls and whoever gets the baby wins. But the one who's the real mother doesn't pull." And like he says, "Okay, great. Then it's actually your baby." That's like a 1700-year-old parable.
So I know it from the Caucasian Chalk Circle because we did it as a school play and I was in the play as posh lady number one. that was the role,
Alex,
I played.
I think of you posh as posh lady number one. That really explains to the listeners the role that she fulfills in my life. Posh lady number one. I want to come back to Armin. He presented a way in which leaders need to think out of the box. He said, "Jason, it's not just about hard power anymore. I understand that if I'm going to lead an association or a CEO of a big company, or I'm going to be a president of a small state, we need to understand how 21st century diplomacy and 21st century power is going to work. And we need to plan for the future. And we need to think about how to leverage our diaspora because we don't have all of the skills at home." And this was the kind of out of the box, you know what, we're going to need to do it differently than how it was done in the Soviet period, which to me is completely critical. And maybe this is a good place for us to end on or to have our last discussion. Armin said, "You know what, we're Armenia. We don't necessarily have the same advantages of Azerbaijan or even Georgia or Israel. Armenia in LA and in Paris and in Singapore has this amazingly educated and talented diaspora. More than 2 million Russians, I just looked this up, Alex, claim Armenian ancestry. And a lot of the higher-ups in the Russian tech industry and Russian oil industry, they have Armenian ancestry. How crazy would it be to say, no, we don't want you to come back and to help us govern the country? So Armin presented a kind of flexible, creative kind of leadership to suit his society. And I don't know if the S20 Club will ever come into being, but I love the kind of creative thinking that's behind it.
I also think if we don't get the formal grouping of small states, maybe we could get the grouping of former leaders of successful small states to talk about their experiences and share their collective wisdom and reflect on their mistakes as well. Because it's easy with hindsight to have great wisdom and say, I should have done this and I should have done that. But how do we influence today's leaders to apply those lessons to today's problems? And I think that is a very nice note on which to end this week's episode. You've certainly heard enough from me.
And you've certainly heard enough from me. But you know who we haven't heard enough from, Alex? We haven't heard enough from leaders of small states. So rather than them having this like S20 club where they meet in Davos or something, we should just have them on the Disorder podcast. Hey, you're the former prime minister of Singapore? Come on the show. Oh, you were prime minister of Qatar and negotiated the hostage deal and got the hostages out? Come on the Disorder show.
Quite right. They could help us order the disorder. And so can you if you could tap follow right now and being notified when every episode launches. And we'll try to get more representatives of small states on there.
Hey, are you a former president of an important small state? You can write us at disordershow@gmail.com. And I promise we'll have you on the program. We'll also answer your questions. If the only small state that you've ever run is your household or your experiences in international diplomacy are parenting your kids, please also write us at disordershow@gmail.com. Finally, if you want to learn more about Dr. Sarkisian and his ideas, please subscribe to our Substack, where we're going to be featuring some content about him. And we also have some interesting stuff in the links in the show notes. And I really, really recommend that you buy his book. It's by Hearst Publishers. And man, it's one of these quick, breezy 200-page reads where he talks about getting remarried in a beautiful Armenian church, about meeting Prince Charles. I'm probably not selling it well, but I loved reading it.
Our producer is George McDonough. Our executive producer is Neil Fearn. Thank you for listening. And we hope you have an orderly week in the small state that is your home, as well as in the wider world.